This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Honestly, we should just do an open phone show one day, because maybe you can explain what's going on in this economy? From American Public Media. Now, that'd get me fired, right? This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the end of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I would be lying to you if I said I knew what the next 6 or 7 minutes of this program are going to sound like, because holy cow, there is a lot to talk about. Lynette Lopez is at Business Insider. Neela Richardson is at ADP. Hey, you two.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Neela, let me start with you. The statistic out this morning, the big one, the Fed's preferred measure of inflation, we always say, I think that's the rules of business journalism, PCE, personal consumption expenditures. Headline number up 6.2% year on year. The core number, though, up 4.9%. That's less food and energy. The catch with that one is that that's even more than it was last month. What are we supposed to do with this when the Fed is doing all it can to control inflation and it just isn't working?
It needs to keep working at it, the Fed. So what this number tells you is that the Fed's focus on lowering inflation is not misplaced. They have to be really, really focused on it, because it's not a foregone conclusion that inflation's going down. In fact, there is that month-to-month acceleration. Mm-hmm. And the risk is that it's broadening. It's not just staying in energy and food like it is in Europe. Predominantly an energy inflation story. Mm-hmm. This is broadening to goods and services, and it makes it more difficult for the Fed.
I was going to say funny. It's not. It's interesting to observe, Lynette, that nobody's talking about soft landing anymore.
No, no one's talking about soft landing. We're talking about now how deep this recession will be, mm-hmm. when it comes, how long it will last when it comes. Because the Fed is going to have to continue hiking interest rates and slowing down this economy. So I was at a big conference of Wall Street,
big people.
Shocks, I guess, yeah. You want to call it people. and absolutely no one was positive. And the negatives are, 10 years of losses for the stock market and, a horrible deep recession and blah, blah, blah. And the most positive thing anybody can say is this will be over soon. Maybe.
Neela, put on your trained professional actual economist hat and tell me what you see in the next like 18 months. And then I want to move on to some other stuff.
So I think Mike Tyson sums up my views best. Wow. Everyone has a plan until you're punched in the face. Yeah. And I think that's basically what we're seeing here, is that the economy is evolving dynamically in real time. And the Fed is trying to keep up. But if you look at central banks across the world, they're looking at double-digit inflation mm-hmm. rates and a slowing economic backdrop. This is very unusual if you match it with really tight labor markets. So we've never seen this place before. It is a punch in the face of monetary policy, and the Federal Reserve and their counterparties are trying to figure it out.
Well, so speaking of the Federal Reserve and its colleagues and peers in the world of central banking, Lynette, talk to me for a minute about the Bank of England and the I would say chaos, but that's not even strong enough, right? There was a whole thing this week with the Bank of England and the government and taxes, and oh my goodness.
And then everything fell apart, right. The traders just started selling British government bonds, and basically the British government was like, we're going to make money really easy, even though we have this inflation issue, we're going to do tax cuts, blah, blah, blah. But of course, the central bank is trying to move along with other central banks around the world and tighten up to stop inflation. So the government and the central bank are kind of at odds in terms of policy, but the central bank is going to have to step in and stop this horrible just slide in the pound and in British bond prices. So that will mean easing from the central bank in the short term. I don't know what's going to happen to England medium to long term, but the meanest thing I've ever said or seen written by the Financial Times, they wrote about the government's policy, its easing policy, and it said, it is kind of patriotism, I suppose, to mistake your nation for a superpower. The Financial Times wrote about Liz Truss learning that Reaganism doesn't work when you don't have the power of the US dollar behind you. And that is what Truss is learning. It seems like the market is condemning her policy violently. So, yikes.
Yeah, yikes. Neela, talk to me for a second about the strong dollar. It is crazy strong. It keeps getting stronger, basically globally. We've talked a little bit about it here. That's not great for anybody, not America, not anybody.
Well, that's a mixed conclusion, right?
Oh, all right.
So a strong dollar can be good for a consumer who wants to buy foreign goods. It's like if you go on vacation, you get an American tourist discount if you have a strong dollar.
Yes.
But for most countries, it's a really difficult thing. The British pound, for example, has fallen 20% against the US dollar. It's a challenge. And if you think of many of the crises that we've seen in developing countries, they've been triggered by a strong dollar. So it's a concerning thing. Federal Reserve policy is intended to have a domestic mandate, but it has a global impact, and that impact can be detrimental to some fiscal health of some economies, the financial health certainly.
Right. Okay, Lynette, we're going to go out on a high note. You get the last word, and you have 45 seconds to do it. The Atlanta Federal Reserve does a real-time GDP tracker. It's not, actual data-based. It's their predictions and all of this, but they crunched some numbers. And they're now saying, as of today, that third quarter GDP, gross domestic product, is going to be 2.4% to the upside. Do you buy that?
I don't know, but the thing is, the data in this economy is just so confusing.
Right.
Good news is bad news. Bad news is good news. And the Fed does not want to see, it wants to see GDP trending lower. It does not want to see 2.4% growth. So that's bad news for the Fed. I guess it's good news for the American consumer. It just really means that the boom has not lowered yet. We haven't really started feeling the pain and the effect of the Federal Reserve's interest rate policy. So I know I'm supposed to end on a high note, but that GDP tracker basically tells us that the worst is yet to come.
You don't have to end on the high note. But that's some good analysis all the way around from Neela Richardson at ADP. Also Lynette Lopez. She's a Business Insider. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kat.
Thank you.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, end of the day, end of the week, end of the month, and end of the quarter. Good riddance. Say I. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The upshot of that whole conversation that Lynette and Neela and I just had is that this is still, and I think we actually said this, an economy that doesn't make much sense. But you look around, and economic activity, by which I mean consumers, are still doing their thing. So we asked Marketplace's Kristen Schwab to make sense of that.
There are so many contradicting trends swirling in the economy right now. Interest rates are rising, yet unemployment is robust, and so is spending.
Things have not moved in concert the way that they have in the past.
Damon Jones is an economist at the University of Chicago. And people aren't only spending on necessities like housing, gas, and healthcare, things that have been heavily impacted by inflation. They're also having fun, eating out, traveling. It's almost like a tale of two consumers.
Well, there are 330 million people in the U.S. It's, you're not going to be able to throw a blanket over everybody under sort of, one sort of set of financial circumstances.
Greg McBride is an analyst at Bankrate, and he says it's getting harder to explain consumer behavior because the gap between people who can keep up with rising costs and people who can't is growing. Some are sitting on good savings, and some are racking up debt.
It's not just the spending on credit cards, but it's the amount actually being revolved that is on the rise as well.
Whichever way people are spending, it's still a puzzle why they are continuing to spend. And a lot of economists are willing to admit they just don't know why. Ori Heifetz, an economist at Cornell, is one of them.
I talk to you with a grain of humility. We have been surprised again and again.
Surprised about the quick recovery, surprised that inflation is so sticky, and surprised that despite everyone's sour spirits, they're still spending.
It may be, in many ways, a new economy.
Economists make predictions based on history, and history tells us very little about this moment. Maybe something bigger is happening here. We may just be too close to see it. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
We're just a couple of months now away from the long, long awaited release of the Avatar sequel, James Cameron's blockbuster that came out in 2009. Cameron has remastered and re-released the original in theaters, by the way, to generate some buzz for the new one. Grossed $13 million at the box office in its first week. I mention that to point out that the production of the 2009 film and its 2022 sibling are international businesses. The original was filmed in New Zealand and Hawaii and California. Those floating mountains, if you remember those, well, they were CGI, but they were based on footage from China, all of which leads me in a kind of roundabout way to today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Olivia Van Dyke, and I'm the owner and CEO of FilmLogic Customs Brokers in Los Angeles, California. We specifically cater to the film industry, film productions. We ship camera equipment. We ship props, wardrobe, sound equipment. We have moved live animals. Right now, we have an account. We are regularly shipping horses. When you're moving live animals, there's a lot of vaccination requirements, and there's a lot of red tape when it comes to a living being, for sure. Business is thankfully doing very well, especially considering the pandemic. It's steady, but it can be very stressful, specifically because everything is on a time crunch. Productions work on a very strict schedule, and right now there are so many delays, so many challenges, and just having to make sure that we are not failing the production by delaying a shoot an entire day that costs hundreds of thousands of dollars is a lot of pressure. We are watching the global economy. It's difficult for everybody in a climate where we're experiencing inflation and we're experiencing difficulties financially. It's difficult to predict, you know, the trends, because we are kind of an unprecedented period of time financially. We've seen fluctuations that, at least in my history in the company, I haven't been used to seeing. I would love to see more movies happen. I would love to be a part of more productions. I would love to get more business. There's always a fear that your business will disappear overnight. That's a palpable fear of mine, as I think it is with everybody, even in the production. It's not a stable industry. But one of the industries that I saw jump up the quickest after the pandemic was film, because I felt like they got creative. So it could dry up tomorrow. But then again, there's always more popping up. There's so many creative people out there that are trying to make shows and movies happen every day.
That's Olivia Van Dyke. She runs FilmLogic Customs Brokers right here in Los Angeles. You know, we cannot do a story about people's economies without people, right? So take a second. Let us know how things are going for you. There's a place you can do that at marketplace.org. Coming up.
I've raised prices twice this year.
Third time's a charm, maybe? First, though, let's do the numbers. I totally expected the Wawa's today. Totally did. Shows what I know. Dow Industrial's down another 500 points, 1.7%, 28,725. The NASDAQ subtracted 161, 1.5%, finished at 10,575. S&P 500 dropped 54 points, also 1.5%, 35.85 there. This next part is not going to be pretty, but hey, rearview mirror, right? For the week, the Dow lost 2.9%, the NASDAQ shed nearly 2.7%, the S&P 500 off almost 2.9%. For the month, Dow off 8.8%, NASDAQ off 10.5%, S&P 500 down 9.3%. And for the quarter, the Dow's loss, 6.6%. For the NASDAQ, 4.1%. The S&P 500 fell 5.2%. You do not have to check your holdings every single day, people. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. As Hurricane Ian makes its way up the East Coast, Florida is tallying the damage in lives, of course, more than 25 as of the last count. Also, though, in addition to the environmental damage, the built environments. Key roads and bridges have been destroyed. Engineers are inspecting those that are still standing, and the reconstruction price tag is going to be high, astronomical, perhaps. And as Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reports, Florida is going to be building for a tomorrow that, with a changed climate, is going to be way different than yesterday.
There are things we can do to make roads and bridges more resilient to storms. Build them higher off the ground, put them in places less likely to flood, and add features that absorb or divert water.
So that could be things like permeable pavement. It could be things like culverts, drainage ditches.
But, says Melissa Roberts with the American Flood Coalition, the federal government doesn't provide any incentive to do things differently when rebuilding after a disaster.
It defaults to building things back exactly the same way they were before.
And the problem is, the before times aren't likely to come back. Maria Lehman is the incoming president of the American Society of Civil Engineers. She's worked on bridges herself and is with the engineering firm GHD.
Some of the stuff that Florida saw, I mean, they saw a foot of water in 24 hours. Nothing's been designed for that.
Lehman says designing and building stronger structures can cost more, but it's still cheaper than rebuilding after the next hurricane hits.
You know, you're going to pay me now or you're going to pay me later.
Another challenge is that people don't always want the changes that come with resilient infrastructure. Sometimes higher roads accommodate less traffic. Kyle Spencer is the chief resilience officer for the port city of Norfolk, Virginia.
Hearing the roads being narrowed or less lanes makes folks nervous about being able to have their business operations function the way they always have.
And in the near term, Norfolk's experimenting with installing sensors in its roads so it can let citizens know when one's flooded. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
The way the news cycle works in this country, it could be real easy for yesterday's story to be overwhelmed by the headlines of today. So it's important to point out here, even with the damage that Ian has done, Puerto Rico is still recovering from Hurricane Fiona. Just a couple of days ago, hundreds of thousands of homes and businesses on the island were still without power, while a tanker full of diesel fuel sat idling off the coast, kept at sea thanks to a century-old law known as the Jones Act. The Department of Homeland Security did eventually issue a waiver, and the diesel for generators, right, did dock. But as Marketplace's Andy Eula reports now, the Jones Act is still a sore spot.
The Jones Act is officially the Merchant Marine Act of 1920. And Sal Marcagliano, a maritime historian at Campbell University, says the part that concerns Puerto Rico is Section 27.
And what Section 27 says is to move goods from one port to another in the United States, you have to do it on a U.S. flagged, U.S. owned, U.S. crewed, and U.S. managed vessel.
He says this idea was codified after World War I to ensure our domestic fleet could carry goods to American ports in times of war and peace. But in Puerto Rico, complaints about the law are perpetual, says Charles Venator Santiago at the University of Connecticut.
Puerto Rico can't sustain itself with local goods. It can't produce enough agricultural goods to sustain the population on the island.
The Jones Act makes goods more expensive for consumers in Puerto Rico. The law is unpopular elsewhere, too. It prohibits companies from shipping natural gas from the Gulf of Mexico up to the Northeast during the winter, which adds to energy bills. Joseph Mikett is Director of Energy Security and Climate Change at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
I'm not saying that abolishing or reforming the Jones Act is a panacea to those problems, but it does introduce long-term costs that should be addressed.
But changing the law wouldn't be easy. The maritime industry has a lot of clout in Washington, and it likes the Jones Act. Sal Marcagliano at Campbell University says amending it would change a century of shipping practices.
those who oppose the Jones Act and those who support the Jones Act both sit on top of a mountaintop, and none of them want to take the first step off the mountaintop for fear they're going to fall down the mountain and the other side will pounce.
The current waiver is for a limited amount of time and only applies to shipments of fuel. A group of House lawmakers has asked for a one-year waiver. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
I've got some friends whose daughter is going to college over in the UK, and I was joking with her before she left that she better be ready to bundle up this winter because school's probably going to turn the heat way down or maybe even off because natural gas is so expensive over there, which is funny, but it's not funny because it's real. It's going to be more expensive to turn on the heat here this winter, yes, but that is nothing compared to what's in store over in Europe. And in the UK, even with government support, households are going to have to pay way more for energy, and businesses, too. The BBC's Victoria Craig has that one for us.
It's lunchtime on a weekday afternoon, and this tiny bakery in North London is doing a brisk business. Customers are streaming in and out for coffee and handmade pastries. It's a pink-painted shop called Sourdough Sophia, and while the mood inside is light, a dark cloud hangs over its owner, who sits huddled with her team in a corner by the window. They are poring over the small business's finances, and energy costs are a big concern.
It's a very equipment-intensive business. All the machinery runs 7 days a week.
That's Sophia Sutton-Jones telling me her monthly energy bill has rocketed more than 360% in the last year to nearly $6,500 a month.
You could either completely buckle under that pressure and pay them what they're asking for. I'd probably be able to shut within 3 months. Or you take what I did, and that is pay what you can and wait for something to happen.
On top of rising energy prices, Sutton-Jones is also contending with inflation near a 40-year high and interest rates that are now forecast to reach as high as 6% by the end of the year. But she is far from alone in her challenges. In August, there was a 42% rise in the number of business insolvencies across England and Wales compared to pre-pandemic levels. So the UK government has stepped in to help. It's announced a support scheme that will cut energy bills for businesses by around half their expected level this winter. Starting October 1st, prices for wholesale gas and electricity will be fixed for 6 months. But is it enough?
Majority of our members are saying this doesn't go far enough.
That's Karen Deer, operations director at the Craft Bakers Association, which represents 125,000 workers at more than 6,000 bakeries across the country.
We haven't got enough clarity. These are supported prices, which are wholesale prices. They're what the energy suppliers pay to purchase the energy, not the retail prices. So until the scheme is actually put into place, we're not really going to know as an industry how this is going to support or affect prices going forward.
It's the same for the wider British manufacturing industry, which often has lead times of at least 6 months to procure supplies for high-end components. The industry group Make UK says because of that, the duration of the support needs to be at least doubled to a year to give some certainty to the industry. Neil Clifton runs Cube Precision Engineering in the north of England. His company makes components for aerospace and automotive giants, including Rolls-Royce and Jaguar Land Rover. He's seen his energy bill soar 266% since last August.
We're trying to mitigate some of the rises that we're seeing by how we're using heating and lighting. We're also looking at whether our night shift is viable for running the machines overnight because there's a lot of consumption there.
But that, he said, only helps on the margins.
There isn't a significant amount that we can do to cap the energy that we use because, of course, we don't generate revenue without using the electricity. What we're having to do is pass some of those costs on to our customers.
That's a move bakery owner Sophia Sutton-Jones is very familiar with.
I've raised prices twice this year in line with realistic price increases for my ingredients. I have not priced it based on the energy increase. I'm going to keep running my business, keep employing my staff, and then we'll see where we go to.
Since she's out of contract with her energy supplier, she said it's not clear whether the government support even applies to her. If it does, she said she'd still be looking at a 244% increase in price from last November. It's a jump, she argues, few businesses will be able to live with. In London, I'm the BBC's Victoria Craig for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, and I don't mean to point out the challenges the UK is facing any more than we already have today, but I did think this item from Bloomberg was kind of relevant. Of all of the group of seven economies, the G7 economies, which are, in case you've forgotten, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the United Kingdom, and the United States, of all of them, the UK is the only one that, as measured by gross domestic product, has not recovered from the pandemic. Okay, on a Friday at the end of the week, month, quarter, the whole deal, here's your moment of economic context. One more from the inflation beat. In the Eurozone, that is the 19 countries that use the euro, inflation there came in this morning 10% year on year. Oh, and related, the euro today will cost you a mere 98 cents American. How about that? Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. And I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you on Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.